Hi, I'm Corbin Middlemass. Have you got Ashes fever? Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It's called ABC Cricket Podcast. I'm joined by former Australia opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, as well as after every day of Test cricket all summer long. The Australia-England rivalry has never been bigger, so make sure you're across every angle. This is the best analysis and insights on the game, and it's coming your way. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Ngunnawal country in Canberra and acknowledging other custodians, I'm Lexi Junawick filling in for Luke Sidham-Dundon. And today on The Breakfast Wrap, Australia announces millions of dollars in fresh support for Ukraine and new sanctions on Russian ships. We'll hear from the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers.
We're steadfast supporters of the brave Ukrainian people who are standing up to this Russian brutality. And the end of this war can't come soon enough.
Then, with less than a week to go before Australia's world-first social media ban for under-16s, one advocacy group is asking what more can be done.
See this ban as a first step, but we think that a very good second step could be what we're proposing.
That's all coming up from the Radio National Breakfast team. This is The Breakfast Wrap. The federal government has announced Australia will provide an additional $95 million in military assistance to Ukraine. It's Australia's first significant increase in military assistance to Ukraine in more than a year and brings the total in defence support to $1.7 billion since Moscow's full-scale invasion began in 2022. Well, in wake of this significant announcement, host Sally Sara caught up with Treasurer Jim Chalmers. And she asked him what he believes the money will achieve.
Well, we're steadfast supporters of the brave Ukrainian people who are standing up to this Russian brutality. And the end of this war can't come soon enough, but it needs to be a lasting peace that does justice to the courage that the Ukrainians have shown. And so for as long as this war continues, we will continue to support Ukraine in any way that we responsibly can. And today's announcement is all about that. This is about contributing to a fund for material and equipment to help support the Ukrainian war effort. It does come as part, as you rightly identified, of a $1.7 billion package over recent years, which makes us a big contributor in non-European terms. And it also comes hand in hand with some targeted sanctions. We're going to sanction an additional 45 ships in Russia's shadow fleet. So all of these things are about supporting the bravery, the courage of the Ukrainian people in the face of this these years now of completely unacceptable Russian brutality and aggression.
You've mentioned briefly these new sanctions. So this will apply to around 45 Russian ships. How did the government arrive at this decision?
Well, we take advice on this. There's now about 200 sanctioned Russian vessels in their shadow fleet. I think, as you know, and your listeners would appreciate, that sanctions need to evolve because the Russian strategy to avoid these sanctions evolves as well. And so we get advice, we engage with our partners around the world, and we take these decisions when it's appropriate to do so. Really across a range of fronts, we're doing what we can to try and strangle Russian oil revenue. That challenge evolves, and so our sanctions evolve as well.
So how will the sanctions work on these 45 ships?
Well, there's a whole range of international legal arrangements. It's why we work with our partners. Nobody really imposes these sanctions completely alone. But we've seen, for example, in recent weeks, stories about some of these ships accessing ports inappropriately. So there's about 200 ships on the list now. They're sanctioned as part of the shadow fleet. That gives them a different status as they try and access the ports of the world. We don't pretend that with every announcement that we completely strangle this trade in Russian oil. They're doing a lot of work to get around it, but our sanctions evolve because their strategies evolve, and that's part of it. But the main thing today is this extra $95 million as part of our efforts to support the Russian military. to try and achieve peace in that part of the world, which does justice to the sacrifices that Ukrainians have made.
Let's take a look at the economy. The Australian economy grew by 0.4% in the September quarter, a softer than expected figure. Were you disappointed by that?
No, not for one second. In fact, the number came in a bit lower because the quarter before was revised up. And there was some unusual activity when it comes to inventories. This was a very positive and very promising set of numbers. And the reason for that is because the overwhelming story of these national accounts was a very substantial recovery in the private sector. We saw business investment absolutely galloping. We saw investment in the building of new homes growing strongly as well. We saw the fourth consecutive quarter of productivity growth. And so overwhelmingly, this is a very positive and a very promising story emerging out of these national accounts. It also means the strongest annual growth in the last couple of years. And so for all of those reasons, these numbers were very welcome.
You've attracted criticism from the opposition about government spending keeping interest rates high. What do you say to those concerns?
Well, it's rubbish. And the reason it's rubbish is if you look at the national accounts yesterday, it's the private demand which is doing all the heavy lifting in our economy. Private demand has now contributed more to growth in our economy than public demand for four quarters in a row. In fact, in the quarter just gone, the private economy made three times bigger contribution than public spending.
You're getting ready to deliver the mid-year budget update. What's going to happen with energy rebates? Is there a case for those being extended?
I will make those decisions in the final few days before we lock down the mid-year budget update. I've made it very clear, I think, on your show before, Sally, and certainly on other occasions when I've been asked that people shouldn't expect that those energy rebates will be a permanent feature of the budget. They are an important way that we're helping people with the cost of living, but not the only way that we're doing that. We've got tax cuts, cheaper medicines, student debt relief, more bulk billing, fee-free TAFE. There are a whole range, rent assistance. There are a whole range of ways that we're helping people with the cost of living. We haven't finalised the mid-year budget update, but people shouldn't expect those rebates to go on forever.
Treasurer Jim Chalmers there. Australia's fresh support for Ukraine comes as Ukraine's president says he's preparing for further peace negotiations in the United States after Washington's special envoy travelled to Russia for talks with Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin says the meeting between the Russian president and US peace envoy, Steve Witkoff, did not amount to a, quote, compromise to end the war. Safe to say, there's a lot to unpack in this story. So for his reaction to international developments, along with Australia's new support for Ukraine, Sally spoke with Vasyl Morozhneshenko, who's Ukraine's ambassador to Australia.
How significant is this funding announcement for Ukraine's fight against Russia with this additional funding from Australia?
I'm extremely grateful to the government of Australia, personally to Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and the entire Security Committee of the Cabinet for this meaningful and tangible contribution to Ukraine's defense. $50 million of contribution to the prioritized Ukraine's requirement list will be used to procure ammunition that we so badly need for our air defense systems, as well as other kinds of ammunition, which is currently available only in the United States of America. We have our European partners who are raising funds, and I was very pleased to see this contribution from Australian and New Zealand governments, and that you are the first two countries outside of NATO who make this contribution. And of course, the contribution to a drone coalition and the materiel and military kit for demining engineering works, but also some other ammunition which will be of huge use in Ukraine.
What do you think about Australia's stepping up of sanctions on an additional 45 vessels, which are believed to be part of this shadow Russian fleet? Do you think they'll be effective?
It's very important to be part of the coalition, and we are grateful for Australia being a consistent member of the coalition of countries imposing sanctions on Russia. Certainly, oil and gas are the two commodities which help Russia fund this war. 40% of revenue in Russia comes from the sale of these two commodities. And of course, if we can limit their ability to sell, that will starve their economy. And that's important to stay together, imposing those sanctions, limiting the ability of Russia to sell and sell oil and dodge different sanctions. And the support, this whole package of support, is a true act of mateship, which Australia is demonstrating.
The Australian government is still considering whether to send its fleet of retiring Tiger helicopters to Ukraine. What sort of difference could those helicopters make in the war against Russia?
It's up to the Australian government to decide if they can potentially donate this equipment once it's decommissioned or becomes a surplus to the Australian defence. Certainly we value any support coming from Australia. And should helicopters be granted, they will be used for special operations in Ukraine, but also they'll be used for medical evacuations. As you know, the biggest problem we are facing is how quickly you can get the wounded soldiers out from the front lines and deliver them to hospitals to provide that assistance. And General Sally, you know, speaking about that support for Ukraine, I see a clear connection how we can work together mutually and for the mutual benefit. Because in a way, in return for protecting democracy, we can also create new economic opportunities for many Australian companies, especially post-war in the area of Ukraine's recovery and reconstruction. A lot of your infrastructure development companies, mining companies, financial industry can benefit greatly from helping Ukraine rebuild in the future.
The Trump administration is continuing its efforts to broker a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine. What do you make of the way those negotiations are unfolding so far?
From what we hear from the latest, the trip to Moscow did not go well. Its negotiations are still continuing, and we certainly welcome contribution from President Donald Trump to achieving peace. It's important that America stays on board. We work closely together with the Europeans and jointly with Australians and New Zealanders. And we must stick together because that's the only way how we can demonstrate strengths. That's the only way how we can put pressure on Russia to make them negotiate in good faith. Because so far they have been pretending to be negotiating while demanding Ukraine's surrender.
Ukraine's ambassador to Australia, Vasyl Morozhnichenko, speaking with Sally Sara there. Returning to federal politics, and during Sally's interview with Jim Chalmers, you heard the Treasurer discuss latest figures which show Australia's economy grew by 0.4% in the September quarter. No doubt the Treasurer is pleased with the result, but what does the opposition have to say? Here's Shadow Minister for Finance, James Paterson.
Senator, welcome back to Radio National Breakfast.
Good to be with you.
The Shadow Treasurer, Ted O'Brien, yesterday acknowledged that these figures aren't a catastrophe. Can you see some positive signs in the latest data?
Only very limited ones, because growth came in about half of what the market expected it to be. And an annual rate of growth of 2.1% by historical terms is actually pretty modest economic growth. And yet, even still, we're seeing a breakout of inflation. That's the most worrying thing out of the figures. And the Deputy Governor of the RBA, Andrew Hauser, has drawn attention to this. An economy growing that slowly shouldn't be generating inflation, but inflation is now above the target band, both in headline terms and underlying terms, and the RBA is having to contemplate potentially interest rate increases rather than further cuts that many Australians are relying on.
Why do you think inflation is still running with those kind of growth figures?
Well, the RBA has been very clear that this is due to productivity. Australia's productivity performance, particularly under this government's watch over the last few years, has been disastrously bad. It went backwards by about a decade on the government's first term. And even in these figures, the growth in productivity is really anemic. It's really just ticking along at the lowest levels we've seen in a long time. And so if the economy is not becoming more productive, then it can't grow very fast without generating inflation. And that's what's happening.
Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, says the big story out of this data is what he describes as the stunning improvement in new business investment alongside welcome growth in housing investment. Do you agree with his assessment on those issues?
I think stunning is a bit strong, and he might be willing to declare mission accomplished on private sector investment, but that's not what any market sector economists are saying. It's an increase from the previously very low levels of investment, and it appears to be driven primarily by investment in data centres, which is a good thing, but that's not an economy-wide uptick in private sector growth. Actually, what we're saying is that public spending is at 40-year highs under this government's watch, and the Reserve Bank Governor testifying before a Senate committee yesterday acknowledged that all else being equal, if deficits are growing, as this government's deficits are, then that puts upward pressure on interest rates.
The government is going to make a decision for the mid-year budget update on whether to extend the energy rebate, which we were just discussing. What would the coalition do?
Look, it's a hypothetical of what we would do if we were in government. I mean, our priority would be fixing the energy system so that these kind of subsidies weren't necessary, and it wasn't necessary to also subsidise heavy energy users like Tomago and other smelters. We want to have an energy system which is competitive and affordable, and we wouldn't want to have in perpetuity, as I think the Treasurer doesn't want, subsidies which mask the costs of the energy system. So that would be our focus and our priority.
When you look at the situation for households, do you think those rebates need to continue right now?
Well, I do agree with the Treasurer when he says that they can't continue forever. It's a matter for government to decide whether they should continue for a little while, but I think in the long term, everybody agrees, with a budget heading to a $42 billion deficit this financial year, it's just not sustainable in perpetuity to pay these bills. So it's up to the government to decide when they
turn
that tap off.
So you don't have a view one way or the other for this decision?
Well, we're not in government, and it's really a matter for the Treasurer and the Expenditure Review Committee of Cabinet. They've got to decide, do they want Australians to feel the full weight of the energy policy failure on this government's watch, a 40% rise in electricity prices, or are they going to continue to try and mask that and let the budget bear the burden of that failure?
So we won't hear any criticism from the opposition one way or another when this decision comes through?
Well, we'll express a view depending on what the details are. I think it matters what the details are.
Government has confirmed it's asked federal departments and agencies to find further efficiencies up to 5%, but it says it's not an exercise in job cuts. Does the coalition believe the number of public servants currently is about right?
The government's been really tricky about this. They're refusing to release the correspondence. They initially tried to say that the correspondence didn't exist before admitting it actually did exist. It just came from the acting Prime Minister, not the Finance Minister. I'd like to see the details of what savings the government is seeking. They're calling them reprioritisations. Of course, when you do cuts, it's reprioritisations. When your political opponents do cuts, it's cuts. I think they should just be upfront and honest and say that they plan to cut spending, and we want to see exactly where that is. It's no question the public service has ballooned significantly on this government's watch. We'll wait and see where it's at the end of the term before we decide what our policy response would be.
So there's not a view at the moment on that issue?
Only that we acknowledge that we got the policy wrong at the last election. It would have been very difficult to implement and deliver in practice, and whatever we take to the next election will be different to what it was at the last election.
Let's look ahead to the new year. The coalition has made it through a very difficult period. Do you and your colleagues now need to rally behind opposition leader Susan Lee as we go into the new year?
I think it is important that we demonstrate unity and discipline. I think it was understandable after a big election loss that we wanted to have a debate about the future direction of the party, but I've been saying consistently for months now that that's not a debate that can continue forever, and that our task now is to hold the government accountable for their policy failures and to articulate our alternative vision for Australia and demonstrate that we've done the policy work that makes we're ready for government. And so that's my focus.
James Paterson, Shadow Minister for Finance. In less than 1 week, Australia's world-leading social media ban for under-16s will kick in. But as platforms such as Facebook, Snapchat and TikTok prepare for a mass exodus of young users, one advocacy group is asking what more can be done. Teach Us Consent is petitioning the government to force social media platforms to allow users to opt in or out of algorithms as part of their so-called Fix Our Feeds campaign, which launched this week. For more on this, Sally caught up with Chanel Contos, the chief executive of the advocacy group Teach Us Consent and 2023's New South Wales Young Woman of the Year.
Tell me about this issue here. Why do you think it'd be a good idea for people to be able to opt in or opt out of algorithms on those social media platforms?
I think there's a few different reasons. Where we're coming at this from Teach Us Consent is, first and foremost, we're a violence prevention organisation. And what we're seeing with multiple experiments around the world and a growing body of research is that when you sign up to a social media platform, if you're a boy or a man, in under 23 minutes, you'll be fed extreme misogynistic content. And that's been engineered by these algorithms, and they've told our feeds to show us these things. And what we're seeing is an effect in real life. We have rising attitudes of misogyny. And what we know from various bodies of research, including a recent ANRO study, is that increased attitudes and support of these sorts of narratives of, you know, believing women are property, and excusing male violence are linked with, you know, the perpetration and the excusing of violence against women. We also think that this campaign will simply give Australians more choice. So what's important to us is that we go for an opt-in system where when you download a social media app, the default is that you are not exposed to these algorithms, and we feel that will give a lot of teenagers a much softer landing on social media and also be a tool for parents to use as potentially a compromise for their teens to use social media when they get there. But it also means that any everyday Australian can use this feature whenever they want, if they want. And it's something that, if you don't feel applies to you, can simply just be an option for another person.
What do we know about the attitudes of the companies behind these social media platforms to this kind of idea to switch off the algorithms? I imagine the algorithms are right at the heart and soul of the business models here in many cases.
It is. I mean, they're profit-driven businesses, and algorithms are engineered to increase profit ultimately, which is exactly why they put out content that invokes outrage, fear, insecurity, desire. It's not an accident that the most polarizing content, the most extreme content of any kind, the most shocking content is what gets the most reaction. And obviously, no private company likes being regulated, except we're talking about multi-billion dollar companies here, some of the biggest in the world. And big tech doesn't like being regulated, but it can be regulated, except it can only be regulated by the government. And what's a really good beacon of hope for us here in Australia is the EU has introduced a similar policy, slightly different, but at the end of the day, the same sort of features very recently. It's not far enough down the track to have an evaluation of it yet, but users in the EU are able to turn off their algorithms, except re-emphasising what's key about this policy for us is we're bringing affirmative and informed consent to our screens now, and thinking when you download an app, the algorithm's not there to bombard you instantly and recruit you into these spaces, because we do not believe that young men are actively seeking this content. We know it's being propagated to them.
From next Wednesday, Chanel, Australians under the age of 16 will no longer be able to access certain social media platforms. Your group provides a lot of content around consent education. What will this ban mean for organisations like Teach Us Consent, which are often using social media to get important messages to young Australians?
Yeah, Teach Us Consent started off a social media movement, which was incredible, and I'm so thankful for. We've, you know, gained 50,000 signatures for mandated consent education, and our current petition, Fix Our Feeds, is in the first 36 hours, we're up to, I think, 3,200 signatures, and that's mainly through social media and also media like this. So please do go sign our open letter if you're listening to this. But so there's a lot of benefits to that, except being on here as a violence prevention organisation. Overall, I feel right now the current harms are outweighing the good, and we are really comfortable to reach young people with consent messaging in other spaces, whether that be sporting clubs, at school, through religious groups and community, and also speaking with parents and other caregivers. We also see this ban as a first step, but we think that a very good second step could be what we're proposing.
Chief Executive of advocacy group Teach Us Consent, Chanel Contos there. Well, that's about all we've got time for on The Breakfast Wrap today. Every interview was presented by Sally Sara and produced by the Radio National Breakfast team, while The Breakfast Wrap was produced by Josephine Asher. I'm Lexi Junowick. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll be back the same time tomorrow.